Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to The Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I'm here to welcome you to the post-diet revolution. Making peace with food means no more counting calories or carbs, no more thinking about food all the time. It really is possible to lose weight and gain health, all without ever going on another diet. So we're going to talk about some strategies to lose weight without dieting a little later in the show, so be sure to stick around. But first, I want to switch gears just a little, but actually not as much as you may think. Last week, two very famous, very successful people committed suicide. Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain seemed to have it all. From all accounts, they each had achieved extraordinary success. They had fame, they had fortune, all while appearing to do what they were passionate about and what fulfilled them. But both were hiding their pain due probably to the stigma of depression. Kate Spade was reportedly suffering from depression and anxiety, according to her husband, but she supposedly refused treatment because she didn't want to tarnish her happy Kate Spade image. Anthony Bourdain battled depression, saw a doctor, but chose not to follow the doctor's advice. Neither of them could face the consequences of the stigma that could come from opening up and sharing that they needed help. So both suffered silently and alone. And they each had children, which is the part of this tragedy that I just can't really wrap my head around. They had people in their lives who loved them, and yet they each chose to end their lives. And that has been so incomprehensible, so sad, and so stunning for so many people. And in part, this shock is because we tend to think that when we are successful, when we lose weight, when we have whatever is missing in our lives or what we think is missing, then we will be happy. But what happens when you have it all and you're still not happy? That can be devastating because it means there's a loss of hope, a loss of the illusion that if we just have X, if we just have whatever, fill in the blank, that our lives will change for the better and we'll be happier and content. Losing that hope that if something changes, everything changes, losing that hope can plunge people into the darkest pit of despair. Now, here's something that may also shock you. Having bariatric surgery increases the risk of suicide. And by the way, I'm not going to be talking about suicide the whole show. I feel like it's very important to talk about this because we need to let people know that there is help and that there's a reason that why people get to this level of depression, whether it is brain chemistry or circumstances. I want you to know that there is help. There is hope. But I need to talk about this a little bit before I get to the strategies of what to do differently. So having bariatric surgery increases the risk of suicide. One research study looked at weight loss after bariatric surgery. It compared more than 400 severely obese patients who had gastric bypass, and they compared them with more than 700 similar control patients who did not undergo the surgery. So the study showed the positive impact of the surgery and the subsequent weight loss because of the surgery on diabetes, hypertension, and other diseases. So everything got better. No surprise, when you lose weight, you know, you get healthier physically. It also said, and by the way, this was kind of an afterthought stuck into the article reporting on this about halfway through, there were 7 suicides in patients who underwent bariatric surgery, but none in the other patients. Really? 7 suicides? And apparently that was not the only study that showed a correlation between bariatric surgery and suicide. A study in Sweden showed that patients who got bariatric surgery in the 9 years between 2001 and 2010 were nearly 3 times more likely to attempt suicide than people in the general population. And this study only looked at hospitalizations. So we aren't even talking about all the people who had thoughts of suicide or tried and failed but didn't seek treatment. Or people that tried and just didn't have to be in the hospital. So had those people been in the study, the rates would have been much higher. Another study found that intentional self-harm emergencies, including suicide attempts, increased 50% following gastric bypass surgery. Again, this study also only looked at attempts that resulted in emergency medical care. So intentional self-harm and a history of suicide attempts are the strongest predictors of future suicidal behavior if people don't get help. They often pave the way for future attempts. So if you know someone who is hurting himself or herself, it's really important to intervene. Now, there are lots of other studies that show an increased risk of suicidal behaviors following weight loss surgery, but I am not going to get into more statistics. You guys get the idea. So why is this? Why do people have gastric bypass surgery, lose weight, which you would think would make them happier, and then end up killing themselves or trying to kill themselves or feeling suicidal? Well, here's what a couple of researchers say. One says it's possible that some people might have really bad dissatisfaction with the amount of their weight loss or be really upset at the appearance of loose skin that follows dramatic weight loss, and they're so unhappy that they kill themselves. Okay, that's an interesting take on it. Perhaps, but I would not say that that is the main thing. Another researcher said it's also possible this kind of surgical weight loss might lead to changes in the way the body absorbs nutrients, so medications that might not work as well, in which case people are more likely to contemplate suicide or self-harm, or maybe they can go see their doctor and get their medication adjusted. So don't know about that one as a leading cause either. I personally have treated many people who have had weight loss surgery, either bariatric surgery or lap band surgery. And at first, the surgery was successful. These people felt great, aside from the side effects, which, by the way, are not pretty. So they felt great because they lost a ton of weight. But what they didn't realize was that eating or binging had served a purpose for them. It was a negative coping strategy, but it was a coping strategy. Eating or binging helped manage depression, loneliness, anxiety, and more. And when they were no longer able to use food for that purpose, they were forced to feel the feelings that they tried to eat away in the first place. Or they found a way around the surgery. In lap band surgery, it's called quote-unquote beating the band, which means that you find a way to eat anyway, and the weight comes piling back on, which can be extremely discouraging. You know, you lose 100, 150, 200 pounds, go through horrible surgery side effects. It's, you know, really intense, and then you gain it back. That sucks. That's when people find themselves in my office or seeking treatment from other professionals like me, because people realize they need to look at the underlying conflicts, emotions, what have you, that lead to binging. They have to look at what's eating at them instead of focusing on food. And that is not easy. Far from it. It is not easy. It is difficult to think thoughts you don't want to think or feel emotions you don't want to experience. It is really, really challenging. But ultimately, it is the key to losing weight for good. And even more importantly, it is the key to emotional health and well-being, which will bring you happiness in the long run. So let's talk about some strategies you can use to make changes. And if you'd like to join the conversation, if you have a question for me, if you have something you'd like to share on this topic or anything related to food, weight, body image, relationship to yourself, what's eating at you, all of that. The number in the studios, 818-602-4929. 818-602-4929. I would love to hear from you. Okay, let's talk about comfort food. Comfort food is actually about the need or wish to be comforted by another person. If nobody is there to provide comfort, or if the people in your life are not able to respond in a way that feels good, that feels comforting, soothing, that is painful. But the good news is you can learn to give yourself what you need to feel better. If you're turning to food for comfort, and by the way, that can often be ice cream, anything smooth is related to a need for comfort. It can be whatever. Whatever it is you're eating, if you're eating for comfort, that's your comfort food. You know, mac and cheese or whatever. It's usually sort of soft, smooth, you know, cozy foods, I guess you'd say. So if you're eating for comfort, your primary challenge is learning to respond to yourself with language instead of action, language instead of eating. If you turn to food as a way of feeling better, you are turning away from something else. But you cannot stuff down your feelings. So cultivating an ability to recognize, value, and respond to yourself without eating will help you overcome whatever's going on with food, no matter what. So one way to do this, one way to comfort yourself with words is to use this acronym that I made up. The acronym is VARY, V-A-R-Y. So the first one stands for validate. V is for validate. So you got to recognize that your feelings and thoughts are reactions to a particular situation, and you have an absolute right to feel the way you feel. So many people tell me, oh, I don't have the right to have that feeling. I shouldn't feel this way. I have no right. Guess what? You don't have to earn the right to feel something. If you feel it, it is a reaction to a situation, and that's it. It's not something to be earned. So for example, how do you validate your feelings? Here's an example. I got passed over for a promotion at work, and my coworker got the job instead. And I feel so hurt, unappreciated, upset. Oh, I feel terrible. But validation, of course I feel this way. How else could I feel given this situation? How else could I be passed over for a promotion and see the job go to my coworker other than be upset? I'm not going to be indifferent. I can't think it away and say, oh, well, c'est la vie. No, of course you're upset. So that's V. Acknowledge. A for acknowledge. Accept the existence and truth of what you are feeling. For example, using the same job situation, this is painful, upsetting, and actually quite humiliating. And maybe you also realize that your sibling issues might have gotten stirred up. For example, let's say that your brother or sister was the favorite, and when your coworker gets this preferential treatment and gets the promotion, it can trigger those old feelings from the past when your sibling got or appeared to get special treatment. So, one thing that people don't realize is that the work situation really brings up the past. So whatever was going on in the past is not in the past. It really isn't. It just gets re-experienced in the present unless you work through it. And, you know, then it can stay in the past. So at work, bosses can feel like parents. So people often relate to their boss the way they relate to their parents, either really trying to please that boss or being very rebellious. Yeah, that boss wants me to do this, but I'm not going to do what he wants or she wants. So bosses are parents, and coworkers are experienced in our psyche, unconsciously experienced as siblings. Something to think about the next time you go to work. So the next one is R for reassure. encourage and inspire yourself by remembering that this situation will pass and you will feel better. You absolutely will feel better. You may not even think about it in 6 months or 3 weeks. And also keep in mind past situation in which you were able to overcome really difficult situations and reassure yourself, hey, I did it before. I got through a lot of tough challenges. I will this time as well. I can do this. So what does that sound like? It sounds like I've overcome a lot of challenges in my life, and it also helps to be specific. So think about specific things that happened to you that you overcame, that you got past. And I'm going to get past this too. I feel awful now, but I'm not going to be stuck in this horrible feeling forever. I will feel better. So that's validate, acknowledge, reassure. And the Y in the VERY acronym stands for yourself. That's you. So keep that acronym in mind, because when you are consistently responding to yourself in a supportive way, when you're validating, acknowledging, and reassuring yourself, you feel better. You maybe even feel good. And when that happens, when you feel better, you don't use food to comfort, numb, or distract yourself. That's how you make peace with food for good. Another tip I have for you today is to watch your language. You know the expression, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words will never hurt me? That's what parents used to tell their kids when they were bullied back in the day. Maybe they still do. Oh, words can't hurt you. Ignore those bullies. Well, that is just plain wrong. 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 In fact, wrong. Yeah. I love my buzzer sound effects. Thank you, Ronan. Ronan is our engineer here. So how about this instead? Sticks and stones will break my bones and words will cut me deeply. Yeah, that fits. Sticks and stones will break my bones and words will hurt forever. Yeah, that is more like it. That's the reality. Words can be verbal abuse, and verbal abuse hurts, whether it's from someone else or from yourself. We tend to think of verbal abuse as yelling and threatening and ridiculing, humiliating, but it can be a lot more subtle. For example, when people are constantly correcting your mistakes, when they're putting you down or telling you something for your own good, that can be verbal abuse too. In her book, Diet Drama, former Miss Virginia Nancy Redd talks about how this thoughtless teasing from a close family member really wounded her to the core. And this person would make jokes about Nancy's weight problem in front of the whole family, leaving her totally mortified, angry, fuming, frustrated, helpless, and upset. And if she said anything, the person would just be like, oh, I was just kidding. Can't you take a joke? You know, I think you look great. But of course, Nancy still felt hurt. By the way, people who say mean things to you and then tell you that they're just joking are just using humor as a way to be hostile. That's it. There's nothing funny about saying something mean. That kind of teasing humor is mean. And Nancy said, poking fun at me made me feel even more secure about my body and myself than I already did. This person had no idea how much the jokes upset me. As she learned, words hurt, and the pain doesn't always come from overt threats. Verbal abuse is a lot more than name-calling, and words can be as damaging to the mind as physical blows are to the body. The scars from verbal assaults can last for years. In fact, a lot of people have told me they wish they would have been physically hurt instead of wounded by words, because then others could see their pain and respond to it. When the pain is within, nobody can see it, and then nobody can offer help. So what does this have to do with your relationship to food? A lot. Here's why. Often, the worst bully is you. That's right, you. The way you talk to yourself can be so mean, so harsh, so horrible, that you may just eat to escape your own critical voice. So take a moment, just take a second here, and think about the way you talk to yourself. Do you ever say things like, oh, you're not good enough. You don't deserve to be happy. You're such a loser. Or worse, you're never going to lose weight. Well, food can momentarily take you away from that awful inner critic, that part of you that attacks your spirit and stops you from living your best life. And here's a hint. This is a handy tip, so listen up. A quick way of identifying your inner critic is to catch when you talk to yourself in second person, saying, you're not good enough, instead of, I'm not good enough. Whenever you talk to yourself as you're, that's second person. And often that second person voice is mean. It's a mean girl or a mean guy. It's a bully. So here's how to silence that mean voice. Imagine a mental courtroom. Now you are very well acquainted with your internal critic, prosecutor. Now it's time to cultivate an internal defense attorney, internal supporter. When the prosecutor says you're not good enough, object. Objection. Then take the floor and demand evidence for those accusations. Remember what a judge will tell you. Feelings are not facts. Feelings are not admissible as evidence. If you feel like there's something wrong with you, challenge that. Challenge that notion. If you feel like you should be in a different place in your life, challenge that. If you feel like no one's going to love you at this current rate, wait, why can't I talk today? If you feel like no one's going to love you or be attracted to you or want to be around you at this current weight, challenge that too. If you feel like you'd be, notice all of these feelings are thoughts. If you feel like you'd somehow be more popular, more confident, just have a happier life if you lost weight, challenge that. Give your defense attorney an equal opportunity to be heard. So when the internal prosecutor accuses you of not being good enough, don't accept that as the truth. Demand that the prosecutor define good enough. By the way, that is subjective. Good enough is not a number on the scale, people. It is not something that you can find on your bathroom scale. It is not a number. What is good enough? What forms the basis of this accusation? Is it your weight? What do you think needs to change to be good enough? Are you going to be good enough if you, you know, what? Get that promotion, lose that weight, get married, have kids, have a certain amount of money in the bank. What is it that you think will make you good enough? And where did you get those ideas? Then present some alternative evidence to the court. For example, if you've tried and failed many, many diets, many, 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 many diets, you are not a failure. You are not a failure. You're just really tenacious. So if you reframe it, you could find a different way to think about it. There's a saying that says, The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and over again and hoping for a different result. No, I think that that's the definition of being really, really tenacious and trying really, really hard. You just might be doing it the wrong way, but you're not insane. You just have a really, really good way of keeping going. Makes you think about it a little bit differently, doesn't it? So when you weigh the evidence, pardon the expression, and judge for yourself, chances are you'll come to a different conclusion than if you only look at yourself from the eyes of the prosecutor. Okay, next, stop punishing yourself for crimes you have not committed. Right? So often we feel bad. Oh, I was so bad. I ate a hamburger instead of salad. I'm bad. Really? That's bad? That's a crime? You're bad? I don't think so. Liberate yourself from that inner prosecutor and have a different perspective of yourself and of what you're doing and what you want to do and who you are, all of that. When you have a different definition of good enough, when you have a different definition of likable and lovable, you know, you're not going to use food for comfort or distraction, and you're going to have a healthier self-image, a healthier self-esteem. Think about it this way. When is the last time you said, you know, I like my friends, but I would like them so much better if they were just thinner? That just doesn't make any sense, does it? Who would ever say, I would like my friends more if they were thinner? I mean, you might say, I would like my friends to be thinner so that they are healthier, or, you know, something like that. But you're never going to say, my friends will be more likable, more lovable, just better and good enough if they lost weight. It is a ludicrous notion, isn't it? So why do you think that of yourself? Why do you think that you have to change something about yourself in order to be good enough? Food for thought. Okay, I'm going to invite you guys to call in again if you have any questions for me, anything you want to discuss. I'm at 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. Okay, so I'm on a roll with analogies today, so I have another one for you. Instead of a courtroom, it's a car analogy. So when it comes to your relationship with food, does it seem as if you are in the passenger seat and the driver is completely out of control or in control? So I'm going to help you identify what is driving the behavior of binge eating and give you... Oh, hold that thought. We have a caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Nina. This is Larry from beautiful downtown Burbank. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Larry. How are you doing?
Okay. I don't have any analogies, but I do have a question about something that I heard at least once on one of your shows earlier. You had an abbreviation, I should know that, which is Very, V as in Victor, A-R-Y. And I think that's, you said it stands for validate, acknowledge, and reassure yourself. I think I got the reassure part right as well, correct?
Yes, in fact, I talked about it earlier in the show.
Okay. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
The question that I have is, you know, I do that when things are not going well, and I got to remind myself to stay in the present and what I'm doing now at this date in 2018, not, you know, how many years ago or decades ago. But when I get to the reassure part, no can do. And I don't know if you have anything to say about that, tips, or, you know, I don't know how to do that. Honestly.
Well, what do you say to yourself when it comes to the reassure part? Because the reassure part is both about the future and the past. It's to say, hey, I'm not always going to feel this way, but it's also to say, hey, I've been through a lot. I've been through this, and this, and I got through that, and I can get through this too. So what are you saying to yourself?
I don't go to the past with that, because it just brings up so much that reassuring doesn't become an option in my happy little brain at that time. And the problem that I have is when I'm in the middle of something that's bad, the way I'm hardwired, I convince myself incorrectly that this will go on, for a while or permanently, and I always come out of it, but at that moment it's very difficult. So it seems like all the words that I know to use that are reassuring just seem false at that time. Maybe there's some trick that you know to get out of it.
Well, you say
go ahead.
You're saying you're hardwired, but you are not hardwired. This is just something you have learned.
Okay, I've learned it down to my core, or I've learned it so much that in my mind, that it'll be permanent seems real, and I'm lying to myself. I know that, but at that time, I'm just so caught up in even the moment. Go ahead.
You finish what you're saying.
No, I mean, the validate and acknowledge brings me in the present, and that's a really helpful thing. Usually when something bad happens, it's really bad, that's, you know, kind of traumatic in the moment, I have this quote ability to bring in so many other things in one sort of toxic goulash, if you will, from decades up until yesterday or whatever. And that's overwhelming, but to validate and acknowledge brings me to that problem, that moment. And that, like I say, that alone is helpful.
Okay, so I have a couple of I have a couple of thoughts for you. One is,
sure,
you're doing what is called, you know, throwing in everything in the kitchen sink, right?
Yeah.
This is happening, and this means this about me, and this, and it's always going to be this way, and it's hopeless.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so one of the things that you want to do is just stay with what is actually happening now. What is this situation now? Instead of finding evidence for why it's hopeless, what's actually going on in this moment? But the second and more importantly, language is super important. So when you say something like, "I'm feeling hopeless," there's not much room in that for hope. I'm feeling hopeless. But when you change your language a little bit and say, "I'm struggling with hopelessness," then hopelessness is, it's not within you, it's not embedded in every cell of your body, right? It's something that you're struggling with, it's outside of you.
Mm-hmm.
This is similar to what I tell people when they say, "Well, I'm a binge eater." I'm like, no, you're Larry, and you're struggling with binge eating. That's not your identity. Mm-hmm. It's something you're doing, and what you're doing is not who you are. So,
mm-hmm.
So using the language of, "I'm struggling with hopelessness," it seems like a small mm-hmm. semantic difference, but what it does is it gives you a sense of you against hopelessness versus drowning in hopelessness.
Right. And I'm actually taking notes as you're speaking. The way my mind works in a odd way, as you were talking about, I'm just binging right now. I wonder if while I'm binging, the thought comes through and it sounds like my mouth is full. That would be, anyway, just being silly. Me versus hopelessness versus feeling hopeless right now, but not a part of me. Okay.
Yeah, and when you think of it, same with depression. I'm struggling with depression. Hopelessness is trying to get the better of me, right? Hopelessness is trying to get at me. I'm not going to let it. I'm going to fight it.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean? It's more doable. So at first, you have to really make the effort to catch yourself when you're like, "Oh, it's hopeless," and change that to, "Wait a minute, no. Hopelessness is trying to get at me. I'm struggling with hopelessness right now."
Okay.
Because
really big difference.
Yeah, it's a small semantic difference, but a huge difference in meaning and in experience.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and as you're talking, what I can do also as far as reassure is, you know, tap into the rational part of my brain that in this case is correct. We're not rational beings, otherwise, you know, we wouldn't be crazy. But that is, this moment right now is temporary. It's going to be better, maybe even in 5 minutes or, after dinner or whatever. And just if I repeat that and remind myself that right at this moment, that alone is reassuring. It seems like, if I go into detail as far as reassuring, it feels like a fake apology to someone. And that's not good, but I just have to share that.
Well, if you were never reassured, it feels awkward to reassure yourself. If no one ever said to you, "Hey, you know, Larry, it's going to be okay. You're just going through this right now. It's going to get better." Then it just feels like words. But if
generally, go ahead, sorry.
But if you actually, so you never internalize that for yourself, which is why you don't do it for yourself. But if you actually think of it and make it not words, but actual memories, think about something that you were struggling with that was really, really awful and intense and just took over your life. And think about how you got through it and how you overcame it and how you, mm-hmm. you know, got on the other side of it. And
sure.
remember, maybe you want to write down a bunch of those so that in these moments you can recall, you don't have to recall it, you can just read it. Oh, right. I struggled with that and I overcame that. I struggled with that and I overcame that. I thought this was going to just do me in and here I am. You know, when you have actual items to look at, it's not just words, it's memories.
Mm-hmm. That's actually tremendous. I'm going to do that. I also remember a time when I was, well, I'll share it, I guess. I was struggling with math. I was, I think, age 8. For some reason, I kept crowding the math problems into the corner of the page, and I heard little kids do that sometimes. I couldn't use fill up the whole page. I knew the math, and I was just, you know, just about in tears, and my dad came into the room, and it was bedtime, and he said, you know, he tried to work with me, and he said, this is no good, I'm done. And he put a big X on the page and went to bed. And what I've done is actually go back to that time, and, you know, Larry from Burbank in 2018 works with that little kid and just shows him and deconstructs, and he gets it, and it's a good, kind of a good feeling.
And another,
I think that's
wonderful, and I want you to also use that in another way, that mm-hmm. memory of little boy Larry and mean dad is a way of thinking about your internal mind, so that within your mind now there is a little boy that just is trying his best, but there's also a mean dad who's just going, ugh, had enough, I give up.
Yeah.
And so mm-hmm. so it's not just about what happened, but it's about how you respond to yourself now.
Mm-hmm.
And to talk back to that internal dad and to say, mm-hmm. you know what? You may give up on him, but I'm not. And that's not very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Way
I had
to
a
discourage.
Sports psychology professor at Cal State Northridge who always talked about the term current reality. What is current reality? And that's sort of a nod toward mindfulness, shifting gears a little bit, not to digress, but staying in the moment, getting in that habit just internally is good, but just, yeah, to swim against the tide that way, staying now and I don't know, talking my way out of it.
It's one thing to be mindful and be in the present, but the problem with that is that it discounts the power of the repetition of the past. So if you feel discouraged in the present and you feel like you can't do anything right, you have to realize how you came to these conclusions about yourself and challenge those. My work is all about understanding the past so we can put it in the past so it stops haunting the present.
Right. Challenge the lies, and those lies are 100 times worse within me than I ever heard since I've been dragging them around for quite a while.
Yeah.
Okay. When all those lies feel true, they're still lies. So, okay, that's good. It's a lot of good stuff here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Keep me posted on how it goes.
I will talk to you in 1 week and let you know how it goes, and I appreciate that.
Wonderful, Larry. I look forward to hearing from you then. Bye for now.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that's... by the way, I got a couple of calls while I was on with Larry. Just so you guys know, I answer the calls myself in the studio, and I can only answer one at a time. Can't put anyone on hold. So if you have a question for me, be sure to call me when I'm done with a caller. Who's another caller? Hi, caller. You're on with Dr. Nina. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Dr. Nina. It's Brian from Chicago. How are you?
Hi, Brian from Chicago. I'm well, thank you. What's going on?
So here's my question. I try to get to the gym or to, you know, some sort of physical activity every day, and I'm usually pretty spot on with that, but obviously there are times when that just doesn't happen just because life interferes. And it ought not be a big deal because I'm doing it more often than I'm not, but there are times when not being able to do it kind of makes me feel like the day just got shot. And that, you know, I'm going to lose my edge. I'm not going to be quite as fit as I'd like to be. And I know that that's, you know, probably very black and white thinking. And I'm trying not to be quite so hard on myself when I just happen not to get to the gym one day. But what are some of that type of thinking? What ought I be watching out for? Because I can tell when those thoughts come that they're probably not helpful, and that they might be more, you know, they might be setting me back more than inspiring me.
Brian, this is a great question, because what you're talking about are cognitive distortions. So yes, black and white thinking is, oh, I didn't go to the gym one day, so my fitness is lost. I'm just going to go. I'm going to hell, you know, physically because of that. So it's all or nothing. And that is a really common one. Let me give you some other ones that might, you tell me if these resonate with you. So one is overgeneralization, which means like you see a single negative event as a never-ending pattern of defeat. So if you're on a paleo diet and you eat a piece of toast and you think, oh, you know, I can never stick to any of my diets, and I'll never be able to stick to another diet. I'm a failure at diets. Instead of, okay, it was a piece of toast, I'll get back on my paleo track today, or, you know, or tomorrow, whatever. Like, so that's one called overgeneralization. Another is called mental filter. So you pay attention to one detail instead of seeing the whole picture. This is like, okay, so case in point, my parents did this to me because I got a report card once and it had 4 A's and 1 B+. And all they could look at was the 1 B+. Forget the A's. How come you got a B+? Our family doesn't get B's. We get A's. How could you not get, why are these not all A's? And so when people who think this way tend to go, well, I'm not really smart because I got the B, and that means I'm never going to be smart enough. Not that I thought that, I must say. Not that I thought that, but people do think that. So that's mental filter.
Right. I don't think I overgeneralize, but I do think I do the mental filter, not with anybody else, just with myself.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well,
I wouldn't do that to anybody else. I just do that to me.
A lot of these are exactly. Many people treat other people one way and themselves a whole other way. In fact, sometimes I'll listen to people say things to themselves and about themselves, and I'll say, would you say that to anybody else? And they say, I would never say that. That's so mean. You know, there's a great quote, if you talk to your friends the way you talk to your body, you'd have no friends left. So if you talk to your friends the way you talk to yourself, you might have no friends left either. Do you want to hear you want
to
hear a couple more?
I have a list. Please.
Okay. So another one is called disqualifying the positive. And that's when you reject positive experiences or positive input or, you know, someone or compliments or something, and say they don't count for some reason. So it helps you maintain a negative belief despite what people tell you. So, you know, like if you think you're unattractive or stupid, when other people, not you, Brian from Chicago, but people out there might think that they're unattractive or stupid, and when others tell them, no, you're attractive, you're smart, they'll make excuses like, oh, they're just saying that, or something like that. I hear this a lot with my patients. I'll say something, some quality in them that I see in them, and I'll say, but, you know, you're so bright and you're so, you know, whatever it is. And they'll say, oh, well, you're just saying that. You have to, because you're my therapist. No.
So would you say that an example of that would be like an inability to kind of readily accept a compliment without getting a little squirmy about it?
Yes, definitely. Or
all right, then I'll check that box too.
Another one is mind reading. You decide that someone is reacting negatively without really knowing. Like, people say things like, I saw this guy at the bar and he was checking me out. But at first I thought maybe he liked me. But then I thought, no, what am I thinking? Like, he's thinking I'm too heavy. He's thinking no one would ever want to be with that girl, or she's thinking I don't make enough money because I drive a Prius or. People, so it's mind reading, but really the mind that you're reading is your own mind projected into other people, your own negative thinking projected into other people, and then you mind read them.
Or maybe like somebody said something like that to you once, and every time somebody else speaks the opposite, you kind of keep re-experiencing what you went through before.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Hey, I'll just keep going. You tell me, you tell me when you've had enough of these.
No, I'm having fun and simultaneously making a mental checklist of all the ones I fall into.
Okay. Okay, another one is called, it's actually two. It's magnifying or minimizing. And that means you exaggerate the importance of certain things, but you minimize the importance of other things. So you magnify, and generally it's magnifying like a minor mistake that you do becomes like the worst thing in the world, or you minimize your achievements. So, everyone, I studied hard and got all those A's, so that's no big deal.
Check.
Okay.
I got stuff to work on.
Hey, we all do. These are not signs of like there's something wrong with you. These are just signs of ways of thinking that you might want to challenge and reassess the way you think. And once you realize that you are thinking this way, you can actively challenge it. When you don't realize that you're thinking in these ways that are distortions, it just feels like reality. And this is all people. All people have many of these.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're just saying that to be nice.
No!
I'll challenge that thought.
Good one. Yes, I see you're very good. You're very good at disqualifying the positive. I see that about you. You got to learn to be less good at it.
Yeah, I'll try to erode those abilities and maybe strengthen some others.
And the last one. There are more, but the last one I'll talk about today is another one I see really commonly, which is emotional reasoning. So you feel a certain way, and then you think that's the way it really is. I feel it, so it must be true. Mm-hmm.
I heard somebody put that once as when feeling feels like fact.
Yes, and feelings are. I said it earlier today in the show. I don't know if you were listening, but I said, one of the things in the mental when you're in the courtroom, the inner courtroom, is you challenge that feelings are not facts. So just because you feel it does not make it so. Exactly. So.
Okay.
Definitely.
Good stuff. Thank you, as always.
And one last one. I can't help myself. Just one last one, because it's my pet favorite, which is should statements. Like people who try to either motivate themselves with should or shouldn't, or they feel like they should have known, say things like, oh, well, I should have known better. And they accuse themselves of lacking omniscience. I should have known better. How should you have known better? Are you supposed to see the future? So I tell people, don't should on yourself. It is not nice.
Nice. Well, I'm glad we ended on that one, because I actually don't do that one. So that left me with a good feeling.
Yay!
Wow. You had that sound effect ready just for that moment? That's amazing.
I had it ready. I love my sound effects. Yes.
That's cool. I don't think I've heard your sound effects before. That's pretty cool.
Oh, I have an even bigger one. Yeah. See what happens when you're a regular caller and you get to have these. So
I've achieved the plug status. That's cool.
Well, thank you so much for another wonderful question that I think a lot of people will be able to relate to. And try not to be so hard on yourself.
I will, and I will be listening. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
And that is our show for today. Thank you so much for joining me here on LA Talk Radio, the Dr. Nina Show. I am here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific. You can listen live or listen to iTunes, Google Play, or anywhere that you can hear a podcast, because now the show is everywhere. Yay. Wait, that deserves another yay. I'm going crazy with the effects.
Yay!
And you can also find me on winthedietwar.com, which is my website, where I offer some free guides and blueprints and downloads for you to make peace with food and feel better about yourself. See you next week. Thanks for joining me.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.